I'm Tammy Vindonge, your host for Executive with a Cause. Today on the show, I welcome James Petisic, the co-founder of PV Industries. Today, we're going to chat about the good, bad, and hard things about running a social enterprise. James, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tammy. Good to be here.
I learned about your company, I think it was through a LinkedIn post that your co-founder, Timothy Donson, had posted on LinkedIn. And I was so fascinated because I know from my previous podcast, Plastics Revolution, that solar panels are incredibly difficult to recycle. And when I saw that there was a company that was doing it here in Australia, and that's all he did, I was very, very interested. So I reached out to you guys to have a chat. And so thank you, James, for joining me today.
Oh, well, thanks for reaching out and having me. It's much appreciated.
Well, for those who are not aware of what you do at PV Industries, can you please tell us a little bit more about the business and also why you started the business?
Sure. So I guess at the highest level, PV Industries is a solar panel recycling company. That's what we started to do. And that's solely what we do. So rather than branching out into broader e-waste, we just saw a niche targeted problem. And I guess I had received some advice when I was younger, if you do something, make sure that you're the best at it and do it properly. So find a little niche target area, and it was a really early industry. There was only one other company doing what we're doing now when we started. So you know, two companies in the whole of Australia, Australia being one of the largest, takers up of solar panels around the world. We thought it was a great opportunity that was presenting itself, a large issue that no one had really thought about, and obviously no real solutions in place at the time. And even today, you know, the industry is always growing, and there is nobody in the world with sort of a gold standard solar panel recycling process. So it's a space that we're able to put a bit of our, you know, creative touch on. And what's most exciting for me is being able to influence in an area which hasn't yet been solved. So I think that's the biggest attraction for me right from the outset, was the ability to forge your own path and be a pioneer, and be part of something new.
What's your background, James? How did you get into this business?
Well, my background is totally not recycling or waste or solar. My background, I studied agricultural economics at the University of Sydney, and then I went into software sales for Oracle, large, obviously, tech company. And it was through some conversations in that role with some local councils that sort of got me thinking about this area. And I'd always wanted to start my own business, and I always was fascinated by the waste industry. I was the sort of person that, compost at home and tear off the little plastic bit of the tissue box and separate the plastic from the paper. And through the conversation I had with this waste representative, it sort of got me on a three-month sort of research journey. And at the end of that process, I thought, bugger it, I will have a go. And that's how it started. It was just, why not? And like I said earlier, no one was doing it, and a brand new space. And yeah, let's give it a go.
So given your unusual background for someone who's getting into this space, how did you learn how to do this, given that nobody else was doing it?
That's a good question. It's a lot of learning by doing, and as you know, owning your own business is more problem solving than anything else. So we sort of surrounded ourselves with people that had been there before. People like the University of New South Wales was a partner that we sort of a partnership we forged quite early, and has sort of continued to hold us in good stead. And they're a partner of ours today in many different aspects of some grant funding that we've recently received. We also got on board probably halfway through the life of the business today. So probably a year and a half, 2 years into the business, we brought on a business partner, Troy, down in Melbourne. So he's a third generation in the waste game and super technical when it comes to machinery, and his wealth of knowledge around machinery and waste is second to none. So surrounding ourselves with people that are obviously more intelligent than we are in the waste or the solar space, but from the outset, it was, like I said, research, having conversations with people. I think, and the one thing that I have learned through both my professional career and the entrepreneurial one, is it's okay to say that you don't know something. And if you ask someone a question and say, look, I'm not too sure about this, and I'm new for doing this, and how does this aspect of a solar panel work? Obviously with the end in mind, but from approaching someone from a solar background to say, yeah, I'm not too sure, can you teach me? People are more than happy to share their knowledge 95% of the time.
Now, solar panels are pretty large systems. I'm trying to picture how you actually recycle this. Is this done manually?
I'll say semi-manual. It's not completely automated. You still have to pick up the panel and put it on pallets or on the machinery that we have. But we do have some components of machinery, which obviously remove the heavy lifting, pardon the pun, that they take off the frames and the junction boxes and the glass and sort of separate cleanly the various components of a panel. Like you said, they are big, and you said it right at the outset, they're not really made to be broken apart. They're made to be on roofs for a very long time. So the deconstruction of a panel wasn't really part of the plan when they were manufactured. We do have pieces of machinery that automate the hard parts of, you know, separating the panel. So the only manual component that we have is obviously picking up and putting down a panel for the machine to do its thing.
And so there's glass, there's metal, there's a battery. What are some of the other materials that would be in a solar panel?
So in the panel themselves, there are aluminium frames. Like you said, there's glass, there's some copper, there's silicon, and tiny amounts of silver that make up the, when you look at the panel, the sort of blue or the black squares. So there are some precious metals in the what we call the wafer, or the blue and black squares. But of course, they're the hardest to get to because they're in the middle of all the glue and the glass and the back sheet that's been sort of stuck together really tight. In a solar system itself, like you said, batteries obviously are very topical and a very big part of waste stream that is going to emerge. But things that aren't really thought about, things like inverters, sort of sit on the wall that obviously convert the electricity to usable from DC to AC, and also the racking, the sort of aluminium rail that panels sit on the roof. When a system comes off, it has all of these components: inverters, racking, rail, battery, or sometimes batteries. Obviously, that's quite new. We're not really seeing too many batteries, but yeah, panels, inverters, and racking are the three main components of an install that we are able to recycle.
Now, you said you had a machine that did this, or maybe it's multiple machines, but it's been my experience looking at manufacturing and trying to buy machines myself that, like, what you needed or what you use, I mean, that's not something that's just off the shelf. You can't just say, oh, I want one of those. So how did you get the machines, I guess, to do this work?
Yeah, so, and it probably goes to your earlier question, which I will build on, around, you know, how do we get started? And obviously with little knowledge, through the research process that I undertook, there were a few, not too many, but there were a few different manufacturers of solar panel recycling equipment. So we did end up buying a piece of equipment from one of these off-the-shelf type manufacturers. Unfortunately, it was not all that we hoped for. So what we decided to do was to pursue our own tech and machinery and come up with our own kit that would do the job a little better and faster and more efficient, I guess, than what is off the shelf. So we went down a path along with Troy that I mentioned earlier. So Troy brought that expertise around machinery. He brought relationships with manufacturers that were able to help us put together this equipment, and not just one, like you said, not just one piece of kit, but two, three pieces of machinery that we could, or, you know, for lack of a better word, stick together and recycle a panel in its entirety. So we did go out and buy, spent my own hard-earned money from the 9-to-5 job, and bought this piece of machinery, got it back, made our own, developed it, improved it, and then going through the process of creating a second and a third piece of the machinery to make sure that we could recover as much of a panel as possible. So yeah, it was a lot of trial and error with the machinery manufacturer. Constant improvement, constant iteration. Literally the first version that we had of one of our pieces of equipment was attached to a handheld, you know, drill, where we wanted to took a sample of a piece of panel and see if we could, if our idea would hold. And once it did with the drill, we obviously scaled it up and made a full piece of equipment out of that concept. So the important thing though is that it never stops, right? Just like any piece of tech, there's always a next version. There's always the next model that we can improve and add things and develop of that equipment. So even today, the machinery that we have come up with, and we do obviously have our own IP on, it's not something that's one and done. We do have to continually improve to, I guess, recycle and break down different types of panels, because like you said, they're big things, and as time goes on, panels are just getting more and more efficient. They're made of different things. They're made to different sizes, to different specs. So we have to continually improve the machinery that we do have. So it's iteration and it's constant improvement. It's not something that we've just gone, okay, job done. We've made a deframing machine and tick. So,
manufacturing in general, though, the kind of work that you're doing, that's not a small investment. And if you self-funded this to begin with, I mean, I can only imagine the kind of stress of saying you finally got this machine over and now it doesn't do what you wanted to do. How did you keep going during that time? Because it just seems like that would have been so stressful to say you just poured all your, you know, the cash that you earned from your day job into this project, and the machine that you bought was not actually meeting your needs.
Yeah, look, that was a tough, decision to, I guess, swallow your pride and say that the thousands of dollars that you just spent on a piece of equipment probably wasn't the best use of funds. But you're right, we've just used the money that I've used the money that I've saved up through my professional career. Obviously, business partners have contributed as well, time, money, effort, all of it. We're going through a process for the first time as we speak to try and raise capital outside of obviously our own hard earn that we've put into the business. Obviously, like revenue that we generate through the business is always helpful. We you know, none of us really sitting here pulling salaries of note to live off. It's definitely been a labor of love. So I will say that I have had my fair share of, we'll call them doubters. You know, you have people, why bother? Just go back to work. And why put yourself through this? And yeah, you do have your days where you question that decision making yourself, right? But I think at the end of the day, that ability to be able to influence a really budding industry is what keeps me going. I guess only time will tell if I've made the right decision or not. But it's a tough one. It's not easy. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, I mean, all startups are hard. Let's just put it that way. But manufacturing in particular is very capital intensive. Mm-hmm. So especially if you're trying to do this on your own initially, that, you know, I could completely relate to the challenges of making those decisions. Now, the question I have then is, from a revenue generating point of view, what's the business model around that? Like, how do you actually generate revenue?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we generate revenue from, let's just say, at the highest level, two avenues. One, when panels come in. So we'll charge a what we call a gate fee. So there's a dollar value that we charge per panel. Obviously that obviously helps from a revenue perspective, money in. There's money out from a labor and outgoings perspective to process that. And then the material that we produce is also sold on the back end. So things like the aluminium, there's readily available markets from, you know, scrap metal that we can take the aluminium to, and the copper cable to also generate revenue for the business. So when a panel comes in, we get revenue, and when pieces of that panel go out on the back end, that's also revenue. So it's a sort of two-pronged approach.
Okay.
From a revenue perspective. So yeah, it's space is a big thing, because like you said, panels are not small pieces of equipment. So the more space that you have, the more panels that you can receive and process and get in and get out. So there's two forms, I guess. Like I said, revenue from per panel on the way in, and revenue from materials that we generate on the way out.
And do you generate more revenue from the gate fee or from the actual selling of the materials?
At the moment, it's predominantly from the gate fee. The longer term vision, and as the business develops and we have as we create more end markets, the idea is the price, and the price has come down substantially since we started, probably around a third, if not more, two-thirds, if not a more. So the price now is a third per panel of what it was when we started, purely because we're able to recover more of the panel. And as we get further into the panel, so when you think of frame and the glass, and then in the middle of those, like I said, the precious metals like the silicon and the silver and the copper, as we start to be able to produce revenue from those items or outputs, the price per panel will obviously come down again. So short answer to your question, the gate fee, but the medium to longer term strategy is to obviously get the vast majority of our revenue from the sale of the output materials.
And the panels that you're recovering now, are those largely from homes, or are those coming from like solar farms?
We just received one of our larger, I guess, loads of panels, which was from a solar farm. So there was a couple of thousand panels that we received from a solar farm. Those opportunities are becoming more and more frequent. Obviously, as the earlier solar farms are now upgrading, not too much upgrading, but just having more sort of warranty replacements. If there's hailstorms or weather events that might take place, which result in larger number of panels being faulty, then that presents a larger opportunity for us. But I'd say, even though the number of specific jobs that we have from a utility or solar farm or large commercial scale, the number of those jobs are smaller, obviously the quantity of panels that we receive through one of those jobs far outweigh, in let's say 10 solar panels that we might pick up from a resident in a suburb here in Sydney.
And how many solar panels can you process a day?
So the machinery that we have can process 300,000 panels a year on a single shift. So I know I've gone from a day to a year. and I'm not that good at maths to bring it down to a day right here on the spot. But I'm sure we can do the math.
It's say, probably like 300 or so a day.
Yeah.
Let's not do public math.
Let's go 360,000 panels a year, which is 1,000 panels a day.
Yeah, there you go.
So look, it's around about 300,000 panels a day, a year, on a single shift. So obviously, if we can find ourselves in a longer term in an area where we can work 24/7, that number increases. Or if we have multiple plants, that number doubles or triples or whatever it might be. So, 300,000 is a good sort of rule of thumb number that we can work off for one of our plants. Sort of working 8 hours a day.
So does that mean you have a lot of capacity right now? Like you can get 1,000 panels, you say, from a solar farm in a day, but if the majority of your customers right now are coming from individual builders or homeowners, then it seems like you'd have a lot of capacity already.
Our capacity at the moment is predominantly limited by space. So we've got a smaller factory at the moment, again, purely because we've been bootstrapped and funding it for ourselves. We are moving into a larger facility, which is about 3 times the size of where we are today, toward the end of this year. Mm-hmm. So that will obviously enable us to have a bit more of a settled sort of deconstruction line. I won't call it production line, but deconstruction line, and obviously the ability to receive more panels. So today if someone was to call up and say, I've got 300,000 panels, can you take them? I would say no. Unfortunately, it's just we need the space to be able to sort of get through the panels that come in and process them. And as time goes on, we'll obviously continue expanding. We're moving, like I said, into that larger site toward the end of the year. We've got a site in Melbourne as well. And the longer term strategy is to have another one in Brisbane. So the more decentralized sort of hubs that we could have obviously increase our capacity, but having those warehouses or hubs will come with cost too. So it's just a matter of chicken and egg. Once we have the ability to support those additional manufacturing or demanufacturing plants, recycling plants, then we'll be able to do that. But at the moment, it's just purely limited by space and capital.
So you have 3 co-founders, more or less, joining at different times. Do you have any other staff?
Nothing full-time. So it's just myself, Tim and Troy at the moment. We do obviously have help from family that are willing to, my dad is obviously someone that is a massive helper of mine. He's always willing to help come and help process panels. I've got some cousins that are willing to put their hand up and, starting to get into the workforce and they're looking for odd jobs here and there. But it's outside of, people's own goodwill. We only have the 3 co-founders. But like I said, over the course of the next few months, hopefully with some capital injection, we've definitely got plans to scale out and to hire not only, warehouse staff, but staff to help with the running of the business as well. So it's all part of the plan.
And hopefully an opportunity to start paying yourself as well.
That's true, yeah. we often overlook that one. But yes, no, definitely. I think come the new year, we'll hopefully be able to do that as well.
It really is a chicken and egg thing, isn't it? Because I mean, for what you need space, you have capacity, but to be able to bring in enough revenue to pay for even space, you are kind of stuck. So I can see why investment makes a lot of sense right now. Let's talk about investors in general, because I think that after speaking to a number of social enterprises and also just having some familiarity myself, one of the biggest challenges is aligning the right kind of investor with your business model, because impact investing takes a different kind of investor than the more traditional types of, venture capitalists and other even those that are just individual investors. But it does take a different type of investor that may be interested in the mission, not just the return on investment.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lessons that we've learned along the way. We sort of dabbled with investment earlier on, which I think was probably a little early for us. And not only that, aligning our values with the values of the other party was something that we learned the hard way. And like you said, the impact investment space is something which doesn't typically align with the expectations of a normal, we'll call, investor. That patience, I think, is super important. Your ability as a new business in an industry which is still developing, that understanding of Rome wasn't built in a day. If I give you X amount of money today, in 3 months' time or in 12 months' time, I expect that money back, unfortunately, isn't really the world that we live in. Like I said, it's been 4 years that I've been involved and started the business. Obviously funding it with your own money and revenue as well. But when I look at how far we've come from the days of starting the business and not, we used to have maybe one inquiry a week on the website just organically, and now we'll have multiple every day. So without doing any marketing, we can see that need constantly increase without any external, I guess, push. So at the beginning, it was all about market education, market awareness. Today, it's more about how do we scale the business so that we're able to capture the panels that are in the market today. And the biggest thing moving forward that an investor needs to, I guess, buy in to our vision is that we don't have 300,000 panels today. That's the capacity. And it's all about setting up the business over the course of the next 12 and 24 months to be able to put ourselves in the best possible position when 300,000 panels a year is a reality, that we are in a good spot to be able to capture that, and the best possible spot to capture that, not just a good spot. So yeah, it's like I said earlier, the patience and the understanding that we're in a space which is growing, which is developing, and not yet ready to apply the standard or the normal rules of investment. That's the biggest thing I think we've learned, is patience.
Well, I think your numbers are not too far off, though, because I noticed on your website you did have, as part of the big grant that you had won from New South Wales, I'm just going to quote this because I think it shows how realistic your numbers are. It says that 88,000 small-scale solar installations in New South Wales are already over 10 years old. And by 2035, around 300,000 tons of solar panels in New South Wales will need to be recycled or otherwise disposed of. I mean, that's significant from all these little solar panel farms that have popped up everywhere. And then all the homes on top of that.
The homes, the uptake of solar panels, from a residential perspective, has been huge. And on top of that, when we look at these solar farms that are being constructed in often regional areas, right? So it's one thing for a house to have 10 panels, but it's another thing for a farm in a regional area which have limited capacity to receive waste at a landfill. They have hundreds of thousands of solar panels obviously installed. So the one thing that differentiates our sector to the traditional, I guess, waste sector is the quality of data that we know, that we have around solar panels and where they're installed, how old they are. And I guess, rather than extrapolating out, we've got X amount of people that are maybe carrying a mobile phone from an e-waste perspective, and that phone might last 3 years, and we can make a few assumptions and we can assume that there are X amount of phones in the market. we have super good data from a down to a postcode level, which is held by the Australian government, that we can use to project our future waste stream. So whether you're applying a whether you're applying a 10-year lifespan to a solar panel, or a 15 or a 20-year, it's quite easy to take that installation number or the graph, apply a 10-15 year buffer, and say, right, from 2012 to 2022, we can assume that there are going to be X amount of panels ready to be decommissioned and recycled.
Well, the fact that you're trying to set yourself up now for that, recognizing the future forecast, and I mean, that's another issue that the Australian government has found themselves in with forecasting waste streams, just recently with the ban on exporting certain types of recycled plastic or plastic for recycling, has caused a lot of issues in some of the councils that just don't have the capacity to do anything with it otherwise. So I'm curious, since you started going down this pathway of data, and I think that's a really good point that you just made there. Now that you're also in the business of collecting the materials and then sending it back through the back into the supply chain, I suppose, are you tracking that data so you know how much you're actually recycling? And then what kind of tools are you using to do that?
We do obviously track the number of panels that we receive. We know where we've received them from. We don't have any, I guess, technology in place that enables us to, feed that information back. That's always been part of the business plan, was to come up with some kind of scanning. Because what happens is when a solar installer installs a new solar system, they scan those panels, and they have to register that with the government. We've advocated for a while now to say to the different government bodies that there's an opportunity there for us to, scan that on the back end and feed that back in to say, right, that panel that existed on this rooftop has now been received by us and recycled. So the idea has always been there. Again, we haven't really had the... We've had other priorities where we've had to channel our capital, like machinery, like you said, where we haven't yet gone down the path of investing in, technology to help us with scanning and, I guess, not recapturing that information on the back end. We've got it in spreadsheets and in our accounting platform to know exactly where we've received those panels and the addresses, but we don't formally or officially feed that back in yet, unfortunately.
Talk to me when you're ready to use that information. And it seems like such a waste of opportunity right there, even for your investors to not be able to show them what you're doing. I think that is it's going to be really important, as you say, when all these solar panels start to come offline. If they don't have options like you, if you can't grow effectively as you're trying to do, then this will end up in landfills. So I think it's really important for the environment, not just for your own business.
Yeah, and I guess the one story that I'll share to that end, where people have been standing in a landfill, or we've heard stories of panels ending up in landfill. One of the main reasons that we started this business, or I started the business along with Tim, was we heard a story of about 4,000 solar panels that were doing the rounds in Queensland. This was quite early on when we were doing our research and really in the early phases of PV Industries. And we were speaking to a bunch of different local government or councils up there and the landfills, and one of the gentlemen that we spoke to told us that at this story about 4,000 panels that he ended up receiving, he didn't know what to do with them and ended up digging a hole and buried them. And I guess at that moment, we were like, oh, that's not very, that we don't, why would we want that happening in every single landfill, let alone, up in Queensland? So that was the catalyst where we sort of looked at each other and went, this problem is real. Like we live in the city, we see 8, 10, 20 panels on people's roofs when we drive down the street. But when you go into a regional area and people at landfills are receiving mountains of panels, they don't know what to do with them and they end up in a ditch and buried. So it is a real problem. And it's only until you get to see it or live it that you get to appreciate the magnitude of it, right? So it does happen.
It's a bit of an industry dirty little secret, isn't it, that everybody is considering solar, not just to reduce their electricity bills, but largely to move to greener energy, and that's why these solar panel farms are popping up. And yet, what are we doing at the end of the life of these panels? You're just putting it back into the ground with a lot of contaminants inside of it. And yeah, it's a bit of a dirty little secret. Now, I know there are companies and organizations that are trying to take solar panels that are coming off of farms that may not be fully utilized, but maybe less efficient. And they're trying to find secondary markets for that. Are you seeing much of that in even your space?
We see a little bit of it. I think it's a topical, again, it's another sort of, I won't call it a dirty little secret, but there is a dirtiness about it in that the secondhand market is a little gray. There aren't any real standards that govern what a good panel might be. And on top of that, when you transport a panel, so a panel is quite fragile, and all it will take is a couple of potholes or a speed bump in the car or your truck. And if it doesn't crack the glass, it might cause micro cracks in the actual panel. So the testing that is done on those panels before they re-enter the market is something that we see as being super important. Because if it does end up on somebody's roof, again, let's say in Sydney or in a metro area, the quality of that panel is probably a little unknown, and it has the potential to, let's worst case scenario, catch fire and burn down a house. Right? I know that's a bit doomsday, but let's go with it. On the other hand, people will say, oh, we export these secondhand solar panels to countries like Afghanistan. And I only use that example because it was publicly written about in some newspapers. Or to Africa. So I think there was the Afghanistan example. There were some Australian panels that were discovered over there that were helping power an opium farm. So, okay, we're shipping panels, one, to a third world country, which we don't know what those panels are being used for. Those panels are now being used for a questionable activity. And then also, it's also well documented that in Africa, the recycling of e-waste is done incredibly poorly, like to the point where there are children burning off the plastic to get to the copper and cable with no protective equipment. So we're really cautious, and we do not resell panels. Or export, like nothing. We purely recycle because we aren't prepared to, I guess, risk not only in Australia that panel is going to be properly functioning, that we can put our name to and say, yes, we trust that panel is going to do exactly what we said it would do when we sold it to you. But also if we were to export that, one, that country is either not able, when that panel becomes end of life and it needs to be recycled, if we can't recycle that like to its highest possible value or 100% in Australia, what chance does a third world country have of recycling that solar panel properly? Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that there is a known destination and a reputable destination for that panel when it does reach end of life, but also in the interim, how good is that panel, and is it doing what we say it's going to do in its second life? So yeah, there are a few question marks around it, and we know that it is obviously something that does happen, and that's fine. But I guess for us to participate in that market, we just want to be absolutely certain that we are putting quality back into the secondhand market, and that we are then able to receive that panel back and recycle it, so it doesn't end up at the end of the day in a landfill somewhere.
James, I think what you just said there, you know, when I looked at you as a social enterprise, I was looking specifically on your environmental impact. But what you've done is just shared the values of your company and showed how you're also interested in the social impact. And, you know, that is something that a lot of people that don't understand social enterprises don't realize, is that you do look holistically at the impact of your company. And it's brilliant to hear you talk about that and to understand the complexities of recycling even more in the secondhand market especially. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, no problem. It's something that we're really obviously passionate about. And it could be, you know, it may be to our detriment because we are limiting our avenues to generate revenue by not, you know, reselling panels. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that we're doing things properly, and more often than not, we win customers based on our honesty and integrity. Than just saying, oh, you know, we're recycling to a certain value, don't worry about what happened and trust us. You know, we've seen coming from a non-waste or non-recycling background, we've seen some of the reputational issues that the industry has. And again, being a new player, not from the industry, we want to try and shake that. We don't want to fall into that trap. So it may be to our detriment that we've hamstrung ourselves a little bit and haven't generated the revenue that we otherwise could have to fuel the business. But at the end of the day, we like to think we're doing things properly, and hopefully it pays off in the long run.
Well, I think this goes back to finding the right investors as well. It sounds like the biggest challenges you have right now is indeed space. And so finding those impact investors is important. If there are people listening right now that want to get in touch with you, perhaps they have contacts or they're interested in your business, how should they go ahead and do that? Should we send them to your website?
Yeah, the website's fine. There's a contact us form that we obviously receive every email that comes through there. So, yeah, feel free to fill out that form, send us an email, and we'll get back to, you know, the vast majority of people that pop up. So yeah, website's probably the best place. See if anyone knows you, Tammy, they can reach out to me directly. But yeah, I would direct people to the website in the first instance.
Okay, and the address is?
www.pbindustries.com.au.
Okay. Well, we'll make sure we put in the show notes as well. James, is there anything else you want to share with our listeners about your industry or the business, or just a call to action?
I think from an industry and business perspective, we probably covered that quite well through the conversation. From a call to action, I think we've covered the investment perspective. We've discussed the fact that we are limited by space and by capital. So if anyone thinks or knows that they could be able to be of assistance in any way, shape or form, feel free to reach out. Like I said, we're going through those investor conversations as we speak. And for any other listeners out there, I think it's just a matter of sharing your experiences and your opinions. Every conversation that we have with anybody else is obviously there's something to learn from that. So more than happy to hear people's thoughts, opinions or experiences with, if not us, the industry. Or even, and the interesting things for me are people that are struggling to make that decision to put solar on their roof because of the lack of recycling options out there. So we have had conversations with people who say, you know what, I haven't even started or taken the plunge to spend the money to put panels on my roof, not because I can't, because I don't want to, because I'm aware that there is this question mark around recycling and the true greenness of that industry. So yeah, always happy to hear people's thoughts and opinions. So feel free to reach out either, you know, via LinkedIn or via our website. The more conversations and opinions we can gather, the better.
Fantastic. James, I want to thank you for you and your co-founders. I was, you know, aware of the environmental impacts of solar panels to begin with from a recycling point of view. And to find a company like yours that is trying so hard, you guys are gritty as, to have spent 4 years with your own cash pushing through and still, you know, almost there was your first investor. I think it is brilliant and just have to congratulate you for making it this far and doing all the great things you've already done. Love also just hearing about how aware you are of the potential social impact of secondhand market and how you want to make sure that you're doing the right thing even in that space and are willing to give up revenue to do that. So that really shows your values as a company, and that's brilliant too. So thank you for the work that you guys are doing. I really do hope that we find somebody out there listening that may be able to help you guys out, because what you're doing now is going to be saving thousands and thousands and thousands of solar panels going into landfill in the next few years. So it's something that's absolutely required to have businesses like yours surviving and thriving in this industry.
Well, thanks very much, Tammy, for obviously reaching out, having me here on the podcast, and thanks to your listeners for listening to us talk for this period of time. It's much appreciated.
Hi, this is Tammy again. When I'm not doing podcasts, I'm helping not-for-profits with IT decisions. The question for this week's IT in Plain English segment is, what is an iframe? And when do you need to understand this term? An iframe stands for inline frame, and it's basically an interactive website, video, or document embedded in a website. Or, as I like to think about it, it's basically a picture within a picture. A good example is when you see a YouTube video on a Facebook post or a website. The original video is actually stored on YouTube, but you can still watch it without leaving Facebook or the website you're currently viewing. It's important to understand iframes when you are considering changes to your website that may require some sort of integration with a third-party software. Iframes are far easier to add to your website than to build a physical integration to another software. So, as an example, if you want to add an appointment-making tool like Calendly or a payment gateway like PayPal, an iframe can be simply added to your website within minutes by just adding the HTML code. This can save you time and thousands of dollars. However, one of the major disadvantages of iframes is that they can really skew your search engine optimization results because a user is actually interacting with a third-party website, not yours. Also, the iframe view may not be configurable to match the style of your own website, which can feel disjointed. Therefore, it's really important that you consider all the benefits and disadvantages of an iframe versus an integration when deciding the best option for your organization's website. So there you have it in plain English. If you have an IT question you want answered, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn and send me a message. I just might answer it on the show. And if you like what you've heard, please subscribe and leave me a review. To all of you executives of the cause, the world is definitely a better place because of you. Thank you for what you and your teams do every day.